BUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It's Friday night, and we're joined by composer, musical philosopher, and master of the cello, Yo-Yo Ma. That's Meditation from the opera Thaïs, composed by the French composer Jules Massenet and performed on piano by Catherine Stott and on cello by our guest tonight, Yo-Yo Ma. Yo-Yo Ma was born in Paris. His first musical memories and music lessons were Parisian. Then came America, full classical training, and an explosion of genius and fame. Yo-Yo Ma never felt comfortable staying in the classical tradition. His repertoire has covered music from the four corners of the earth, from the touchstone of a Bach cello suite to sultry tangos, folk tunes from Appalachia, and the ancient music of the Silk Road. In his latest CD, Yo-Yo Ma goes back to the Belle Epoque, or the Great Age of Paris, at the turn of the 20th century. It was Paris at the height of its cultural splendor, and music that evokes a time of Monet and Cézanne, the then-new Eiffel Tower, and the one-day dreams of Marcel Proust. It was a magnetic Paris that lured Yo-Yo Ma's father to leave China for the European capital of new art and ideas. Tonight we relive the music of that turn-of-the-century Paris with Yo-Yo Ma, and look out on the new turn of the century we're living in right now, a world of globally shared cultures and globally shared terrors. Welcome, Yo-Yo Ma.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be on the show.
It's wonderful to have you. I want to ask you about so many things tonight. I want to start, though, just with that music. It's a beautiful thing, Meditation from this opera, Thaïs. Mm-hmm. What is this? It sounds like the soundtrack of a movie I want to see right away. It stands out on your album, somehow to me, more narrative than the rest, more personality in my layman's terms. What is it about that music that is so redolent of narrative, of a story, of a kind of an exploration of someone's character? What's going on there?
Well, it's one of these melodies that has been around. It's so popular, a lot of people play it. Mm. And one of the reasons I chose that piece is that obviously I heard it as a child. I was born in Paris. Mm. But I play it with my daughter. I tinker around on the piano. She plays violin. It's a violin piece. And I think that when a father-daughter suddenly you get together and you play some music together.
Oh, yeah.
That's pretty special.
Yeah.
It's like that wonderful conversation in the car.
Yes.
You know, that,
but this is a racy story for a father-daughter piece, as wonderful it is. I mean, the opera that this comes from is about a monk converting a prostitute to Christianity, and then he falls in love with her. Have I got that right?
That's absolutely true. And this melody is probably the best known part of that opera. You're right in the characterization. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's not part of my father-daughter story. But that, as soon as it was written, it became an incredibly popular melody, which some people say, oh, it's so sentimental. But actually, I have such great feelings for it because of both my memories listening to this music, mm-hmm. but also playing it within the family, the different forms of an expression of love.
Clearly an expression of love. I mean, the sentimental is woven right in there, but also you can hear someone kind of looking at someone beloved and seeing them in all their facets, in all their manifestations, in all their depth. I love the way it comes through there. Yo-Yo Ma, take us back. We want some context here on how this music got into your blood. Just give us the straight history to begin with. What was it that took your family, your father and the family, out of China to Paris? When and how and why?
Okay, well, the title of this CD, Belle Epoque, is precisely, I think, the reason why both my parents left China to continue their musical studies. Paris was such an exciting place. The Belle Epoque was the late
turn of the century. As when they were young people, that music was still influencing them. That image of Paris,
absolutely,
that's in this music.
The Eiffel Tower from the late 1890s. But my father left in 1936, mm-hmm. and still at that time, it was a very vibrant place. He studied violin. He went to this César Franck school and studied composition. and then got his PhD in musicology at the Sorbonne. So he studied, loved Paris, and stayed there for 27 years.
Fully immersed in the music of Paris. But even before that, in China, your father was born or grew up in Ningbo, south
right.
of Shanghai. Your mother from Hong Kong, mm-hmm. I believe. They were both musicians, fully immersed in Western music?
Well, I think my father studied both. He loved art and music in at university. Mm-hmm. And, of course, I think just very much like any other place in the world, his parents were worried.
Well, what's up, our son's a musician?
Oh, my gosh, you know, this is... And so they made him promise that if he were to continue studying music, mm-hmm. that he would at least get a degree, a further, you know, advanced degree. And
which, for this, he went to Paris?
Yes, exactly.
Now, what sort of family was the Ma family in China? Was it a family of artists? Was it a family of... You tell me.
I know less about my grandparents, but my father was born in 1911, mm-hmm. which is actually a turning point of last dynasty, beginning of
yes.
the of sort of modern age of China.
Sun Yat-sen would step forward and all the rest.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so all I know that in my parents' history that you know, they were actually quite turbulent times.
Politically, as turbulent as it can be.
A number of world wars, mm-hmm. invasion, civil war. And when my father was in Paris, German invasion, I think, so he was there.
Was part of your parents' reason for leaving China the fact that the Japanese were making menacing moves, the political turmoil there, or was it purely in pursuit of art?
I think in pursuit of art and education. My mother was a singer. She, in fact, sang in this Thais, and so, you know, so
in this very opera that we heard at the top.
Mm-hmm. I did grow up listening to her singing, and she left in 49, and they met, and the rest is, you know, my sister was born, and I was born, and that's what happened.
1955, and there you were at age 4 in Paris, taking your first lesson, sitting on multiple phone books to be tall enough. This was in the studio of Étienne Varillot.
Étienne Varillot, who was a great instrument maker and a luthier, as they call him, a lute maker, lute fixer-upper mm-hmm. of great instruments. And it was in Varillot's home that Saint-Saëns used to have musical evenings. So there were not too many steps removed from the music that is in this recording. Franck was the school that my father went to study mm-hmm. composition, mm-hmm. César Franck. Saint-Saëns knew Varillot's family and participated in it.
And of course, all of the Paris that was built in the Belle Epoque, the turn of the century Paris, the Eiffel Tower, the great boulevards, the architecture that we so associate with Paris, still the surrounding of your father's life in those days, of your life in those early years.
Absolutely. And not only that, my sister, who is 4 years older, played violin. She still mm-hmm. plays. Mm-hmm. And she studied with the great Belgian violinist of that time, Arthur Grumio, who... was essentially a disciple down the line from Isaïe, for whom the Franck Sonata was dedicated to.
We're going to hear something from César Franck in just mm-hmm. a moment, his Sonata in A Major. But paint the picture for us, Yo-Yo Ma, of what was it that still, almost half a century later when you were studying, emanated from that Belle Epoque Paris, that Paris of Monet and Cézanne, the Moulin Rouge, the Brasserie, the boulevards, the Eiffel Tower, and this music. We have the visual images, we have the paintings in mind, but speak to us about the heart of the music of that turn of the century.
I think so much of the music or the salon music, people were trying to say, okay, what is French music? What are we doing? Just the way that they were doing it in literature, in painting. Mm-hmm. And a lot of course, music is written because of sentiment. Mm-hmm. You talked about the meditation. The Franck was written as a wedding present given to the greatest violinist of that time, Isaïe, was getting married. Mm-hmm. And imagine getting a wedding present.
Wonderful.
You know, I just thought of you. And I think the Fauré also was written, dedicated to a wonderful violinist. But Fauré loved, was keen on this violinist's sister. You know, it's the same old story.
So let the sentiment roll. Open the vein and let it roll. Let's listen to some of Sonata in A. And as we do, remember this music being written for a time when you could not throw a Yo-Yo Ma CD on just any time you felt like it, where the performance itself was a moment you had to savor and hold in your mind.
And I would love to suggest, as you listen to their four movements, and obviously you're not going to hear all four, but for me, speaking of sentiment, mm-hmm. I think that piece is really the story of a relationship. Thank you.
Just a bit of Sonata in A Major by César Franck, performed by Yo-Yo Ma and Catherine Stott on piano. Yo-Yo Ma, articulate that sentiment for us. You've done it on cello. Put it into words.
Okay. As you listen to the beginning of the last movement, you have the themes, two melodies, actually intertwined, and one follows the other. One leads, the other follows. The other instrument leads, and the other follows. For me, it's the perfect conclusion of four movements where you get the beginning of a relationship, the storm and stress of a relationship, mm-hmm. going deep within, inside for sort of solitude in the third movement, and finally a union in the fourth movement, perfect wedding present for a beloved musician and friend of César Franck.
Laying out that fullness of a relationship in a gift for a wedding. Marcel Proust held on to the music of this time. It created the memories that kept coming through his mind again and again. You were so young. You were in Paris to age 7. Can that brief an association, when you were taking these music lessons, can a musical impression made that early on last? Do you feel it still in your blood, in your bones?
I would ask you, Tom, when you were a child, there were certain things that smelled, baking, at home cooking, something. And are there moments in your life when suddenly a whiff of something catches you and you say, oh my gosh, this is what I remember when.
And of course we answer yes, and of course more than yes. In fact, those things turn out to be the most potentially powerful, sort of fundamental things, deeper than we can even see.
I think so.
The
memory of smell and the memory of certain voices and of early musical, you know, nursery rhymes and whatever. We never forget those things. And
do you catch glimpses of your Parisian early days? Do they float through? Some is musical. Tell us about that. Some may be scenes, visions of people.
All the time. First of all, bakeries. No, you just,
of course.
I mean, it's so, so incredibly powerful. But in other ways, way language is used, way that, you know, it's a much more flowery language in many ways. And it's a culture that also celebrates the moment, sometimes relishes its contradictions, you know, both rational thinking, but also Latin Mediterranean thinking. And somehow it's the juxtaposition of those two elements that you hear that in a lot of the music, music that tries to catch a moment, that tries to catch a sentiment that is so fleeting, what Proust was always trying to write about. Mm-hmm. You feel it in the music, you sense it in what we think are the French characters that we know from, you know, from films, from, you know, eating croissants.
And you know we're going to drag you a bit out of music and a bit into politics tonight, but right there, just as you were working on this CD, of course, the whole explosion of unhappiness with the French and the United States. All right, here you are with this little bit of an early childhood diving board out of France into the rest of the world. How did you respond to all the French obstinance in the United Nations, holding up the French position, and the United States opprobrium just heaped on France? What do you make of that, Yo-Yo Ma?
Well, you know what's funny? I mean, obviously, I'm not into politics, but I recognize there are such powerful engines in our world, political engines, economic engines, but I believe in cultural engines. And I think at a time when there are difficulties in some of the other engines of the world, I think culture works in a different time frame. Culture, when I think of France, it's, you know, a several thousand years of history, you know, from Charlemagne, whatever. And so I think a lot of that, if we can keep them separate, obviously they join in at certain times. But to throw French wine out doesn't really do much for either politics or economics.
And whether we like it or not, if we go back far enough, we are all intertwined here. Yo-Yo Ma, stand by. I want to come back and talk more about these cultural connections and your own cultural explorations. We'll be back with more of Yo-Yo Ma after a short break. Let's go out listening to Yo-Yo Ma with Catherine Stott on piano from his new CD, La Belle Époque. This is the end of the first movement of Gabriel Fauré's Sonata in A Major. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour with the great cellist, composer, and all-around big thinker, Yo-Yo Ma, from his latest CD, La Belle Époque. This is Yo-Yo Ma, along with Catherine Stott on piano, performing the Saint-Saëns piece, Havanaise.
Thank you.
And yet another slice of La Belle Époque there. Sanson, we talked earlier about, here's another composer. How do you place them relative to one another?
Well, Sanson was, I think, a child prodigy. He did everything well. And he was interested in exploring the world during that whole time. He would write about faraway places, Egypt, in this case, Havana. And why not? Because I think people at any time, at any place, are interested in the wider world around them. Mm. And obviously, at the end of the 19th century, the world was way open. Gauguin would paint scenes from Tahiti, and the composers would actually go way out and also try and suggest the feelings of faraway lands. Mm-hmm. Ravel did that, Debussy did that, Saint-Saëns did that. And so I think he was part of a way of thinking at that time. And this is also, I think, what made Paris so exciting at that time, because the city attracted people from all over the place, like my parents, but also for people to, political thinkers would go to France, and this was the norm.
Famously, for a classically trained cellist, pursued many threads of global culture in the music of your repertoire. It's everywhere. I wonder, as you look at these composers who reached out to Egypt and beyond, in your own experience, what is simply the fascination with the exotic, and where does a kind of genuine sharing of culture come in? How do you parse that line in your own mind, Yo-Yo Ma?
Tom, I think you would know as well as I do, probably better than I do, that the moment when something is shared, I think there's only one rule for me in any artistic endeavor, is that you have to start from the inside. Someone has to take you inside. So you're not analyzing something and say, okay, this is what it is, but I have nothing to do with it, but I know something about it. So it's not about information. It's about an internal organic knowledge of something.
Absolutely.
And you could start anywhere, but basically I always need a guide to take me in. In the case of French music, the guide was being born there. You know, it was all around me. Mm-hmm. But as I studied further, as I went to college, as I looked into anthropology, and of course as I travel as a professional musician, I had people, wonderful guides, to take me into various, who showed me what was important to them. And for me, the essence of sort of the languages of the heart, you know, which I think music is a good example of that kind of expression, it's all about knowing something that someone else feels is very precious, making it precious to yourself. And I think that's one way of building a base of trust.
Something we desperately need right now, I guess, which is a reason we're happy to come back to you and your music, Yo-Yo Ma, because you've made the effort to get inside different musics and understand them so intimately. Also because you forthrightly look at music as an important tool of communication. As you say, cultural communication, sharing what's precious, it can lead to trust. I'd like to... We get you so rarely, and here we have you at this interesting moment, a century after your Belle Époque. Here we are. I don't know if this will be called a beautiful era or not. It's certainly a difficult and trying year. Another turn of the century, a time when we can feel the urgent need to understand other cultures, and yet all the roadblocks and pitfalls and blood that can lie between here and there. Help us with some ideas, musically, from your own experience, from reaching out. Help us make that kind of cross-border journey. What musical themes or ideas embedded in music, cultural embedded in music, is speaking to you right now? What should we, could we, might we be listening to that would help us reach out?
Well, I think it's funny. Music is very simple, because we all have music in our lives. We all know tunes. We all know things. And I think I would recommend listening to the voice of this one singer who's from Mongolia, Ulaanbaatar. Mm. And she sings Long Song. And I'll give you an example of
that. She's on your Silk
Road
album.
Silk Road. And Long Song means, it actually started as a means of communicating over long distances in the vast plains of Mongolia. It's such an extraordinary voice. People say, you know, Luciano Pavarotti voice, you know, that comes once in a century or whatever. Well, this lady is about 28 years old.
Remind me of her name.
Hongrosol, mm-hmm. We call her Zola. Mm-hmm. And we started doing things as part of the ensemble maybe 2.5 years ago.
This is the Silk Road Ensemble that you put together.
Exactly. And in 2.5 years, she's performed all over the world. And this voice, people always remember. It's huge.
Let's listen
amazing.
To just a bit of this. And there you can hear it in the power of that voice and in the Long Song, in its reach. I mean, it almost literally wants to reach out to the world and say, I'm human like you. Can you hear it?
Exactly. And since we all know how to sing, you hear something like this. You know, I only sing The Shower, but this is The Shower with a megaphone in wide open spaces. Mm. It takes us into almost, certainly pre-industrial eras, nomadic eras, and of which we all in some way took part. It is so moving, and very often she would sing at the end of a concert, and the Long Song comes off as a prayer.
And a kind of fundamental unifying song. Stay with this parlor game with me for a second, Yo-Yo Ma. Let's take it on to something, very recent. You, like all the rest of us, watched the war in Iraq unfold on our television screens. And we saw many themes there. We saw oppression. We saw different cultures meeting suddenly and in a violent way. In some way, we saw whatever we wanted to see, and different parts of the world saw different events in that single event. Maybe this is too hard, but if Yo-Yo Ma were to pull a piece of music out of your own repertoire to kind of speak to this aftermath of that war, where everyone's settled down now and looking at Iraq and what's just happened here, I don't know, what comes to mind?
If you're asking about a single piece of music, I think that's...
Is it impossible?
I think it's hard. What I did do when we were just recently in Tajikistan, mm-hmm. which is a country just north of Afghanistan, we were in Kazakhstan mm-hmm. and Kyrgyzstan.
Right there in Central Asia.
Right. And we were doing workshops. And they played for us, we played for them, and then we played together. Mm-hmm. The piece I played was a saraban from a Bach suite, from the Sixth Suite, because... For me, because of my tradition, you know, Bach was a great musician in that he improvised, he took everything that was around him, and he wrote things down. He did all of what a musician could do. Mm-hmm. And what he also did was that he could actually express total empathy for the human condition, as well as also keep everything at arm's length. So there was this subjectivity. I just feel your pain, mm-hmm. but actually there is a lot more. So that piece of music I've played at friends' weddings as well as at their memorial services. It's totally appropriate.
Let's hear just a bit of that.
Thank you.
So there you had Zola with her long song as a kind of call out to all humanity. Here in Bach, the kind of unifier, the empathizer, but who also reminds you cosmos is even greater than your particular feelings with which I'm empathizing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It's a great piece. We're so aware in this last war and in broader circumstances now of clashes of cultures. Your father was attracted to Paris by something that reached out, that was integrating in a way. He wasn't the only person, man, family from Asia that went to France at that time. Of course, many of the Vietnamese leaders who later
Vietnamese
became famous
leaders,
were there, and many
absolutely.
Chinese political leaders were there at that time.
Chou Enlai, Ai
Weiwei,
all kinds of people.
Mm.
Yep.
But today we're looking at a world that is so enmeshed in the clash of cultures, so focused on the ways in which the puzzle pieces don't fit easily. What does your experience with world music or the many different traditions tell you about that? I mean, we don't ask for political analysis, but culturally here, do you find boundaries in music where this tradition and that tradition simply can't meet?
Well, you know, it's funny. I think one nice thing about music is that there's tremendous fluidity because people hear things, they absorb things, and then it comes out in a different way. I've just been working on a Brazilian album, and I'll tell you this really funny story. I loved hearing the voice of a singer, Rosa Passos. Mm. And to me, there was a purity in her style. I thought, oh my gosh, but she lives in Bahia, and we heard that she didn't travel much. She likes to stay in Brazil.
They're in northeastern Brazil.
So, exactly. And, of course, there's a fairly large Brazilian community in Boston.
Certainly.
Where we live. And I thought, well, it doesn't hurt to try and write her a letter. We write her a letter, say, maybe you might be interested in participating. 3 days later, I live in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Mm. Our neighbor, the Morgenthaus, drop off 3 CDs with a letter from her brother-in-law, who lives in Newton, and says, I hear you're interested in my sister-in-law's music. Here are some CDs. Hope you meet. We meet finally in New York. And it's literally love at first sight because she's this wonderful, wonderful lady who is just filled with love, exuberance, kindness, spirituality. And we hit it off. But that is the kind of world that we live in. It's not the clash of civilizations.
Mm-hmm.
Things break down when there's a clash of ignorances. And this is something the Aga Khan talks about a lot, because I think it's so easy to stereotype and to make something into another group or whatever, into something that's monolithic. Mm-hmm. And here we are in Boston. You know, I'm trying to do something that I think is far away. I'm trying to understand the music.
And
which
it's
I love
woven
so
all around your
it's
feet.
Absolutely around me. And a friend of mine who listened to this album said, who lives also in Newton, says, Lin Chang, he says, where did you find these great musicians? Well, some were in Brazil. A lot of them live in New Jersey. Some of them live in New York.
Some right next door.
And they're all around us. All we need to do is look.
Yo-Yo Ma is not buying the clash of civilizations. He's reaching out through music to the things that bind us together. So she ended up on your CD, and I haven't heard all of that CD. This is Obrigado Brasil.
Mm-hmm.
But she's singing there. Can we hear a bit of that?
Absolutely.
What does she sing?
What she sings is the Jobim Chega de Saudade.
Back with more of Yo-Yo Ma after a short break. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Milhões de abraços apertado assim, colado assim, calado assim. Abraços e beijinhos e carinhos sem ter fim. Que é pra acabar com esse negócio de você viver sem mim. Não quero mais esse negócio de você longe de mim. negócio de você viver assim. Que é pra acabar com esse negócio de você viver sem mim. Não quero mais esse negócio de você longe de mim.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're joined this hour by cellist Yo-Yo Ma. And here from an upcoming CD entitled Obrigado Brasil, this is Doce de Coco, a song he's playing along with clarinetist Paquito de Rivera and guitarist Romero Lumbambo. Wow, is that comfortable, nice music. We just want to scooch down into it and enjoy it all night. What a lucky man you are, Yo-Yo Ma, roaming the world and you get to sit down with these wonderful musicians. Tell us about this piece.
Well, I have to tell you that when I listen to this music, I've loved Brazilian music for a long, long, long time. But actually, it's one thing to listen to it, and then it's another thing to be a participant in it. Mm. But then after you've been a participant, you become a listener again. You're always doing both. And to be able to play with Romero, who's actually both Romero and Paquito are classically trained musicians. Paquito comes from Cuba, but he's been now in New York for over 20 years. And as soon as he arrived, he got very much into Brazilian music, which of course have some of the same roots from West Africa also. So there was a great kind of joining together with Paquito and Brazilian music from early on. But Romero, here's a guitarist who also classically trained, and then became a mechanical engineer, then really, really worked on playing the guitar. He's one of the greatest musicians that I know of.
And into their midst comes the cello of Yo-Yo Ma. I don't associate the cello with Brazilian music.
Well, I think there were a number of great Brazilian musicians and composers, including, I think, probably the most well-known, Villa-Lobos, Hector Villa-Lobos, who played the cello, who actually tried to do with Brazilian music. It's sort of almost like pre-samba days. You know, he wrote enormous, over 2,000 pieces. Aldo Paraso from Yale, who's Brazilian, first told me that, you know, you have to do Brazilian music and you have to go to Rio and go check out this library where there are thousands of pieces of Villa-Lobos. So that was one of the...
It's a wonderful sound. Yo-Yo Ma, you've taken that marvelous instrument just about everywhere now. But what have you found? Is there anywhere that the cello of Yo-Yo Ma cannot go? Any music with which it cannot mesh or work?
Tom, for me, I always ask two questions about any music. It's who's doing it and why. And it's not about the cello. It's about the imagination. It's about what the human spirit frames so that something comes out in the sound world, whether it's something that deals with transcendence, or it deals, in the case of Brazilian music, I feel so much of it hits a point in between the conscious and the subconscious. Mm-hmm. You know, it's a, you were making this kind of physical motion that says, ooh, you get real comfy
right.
in that mode. Mm. And within that narrow band of sort of between the conscious and subconscious, you have the whole world of humanity that can be described within that frame. I think so much of Brazilian music is expressed within that. The pain, the agony, the tragedies, less melodramatic, less dramatic mm-hmm. than Argentinian music, mm-hmm. but in Brazilian music, it just comes out, you feel it all, and it's within that band.
You're lucky to have that degree of mastery of an instrument that you can really take it anywhere, that it's the physical aspects of the cello are not a boundary for you at this point, at least not the one that I can hear. You're really able at that level to write it into whatever environment you're connecting with music.
Well, I think that there's no difference between what you and I do in the sense that we actually try and report on what we think is there. In my terms, it's obviously...
Probe in, find it, pull it out.
You want to find the truth. You want to find some essential truth. And you need other people to try and get you there. You can read, you can be there, you can experience it. But somehow you have to collect all of it, and then we try and report it and advocate for the story the best way that we know how.
Yo-Yo Ma, do you imagine that in your career you will continue to weave in these many threads of music from all over the world? Is that emerging as a distinctive hallmark of your music?
I think that I'm always doing the exact same thing, which is essentially to probe and to report. And I know that whenever I go into something that I don't know, as we travel or do something else and experience another world or another worldview, I come back to what I grew up with, whether it's this Belle Époque album or Bach or whatever, feeling that I'm a slightly better musician, I have slightly higher standards, I'm even more passionate about what I do in terms of wanting to practice, wanting to say it clearer, mm-hmm. simpler. And it's this constant muscle that you use. You go away, you come back, you go away, you come back, and slowly in, you know, small concentric circles, your world becomes a little wider and I feel a little bit more human.
Yo-Yo Ma, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Let's close this hour with the final movement from Gabriel Fauré's Sonata in A Major from Yo-Yo Ma's new CD, La Belle Époque. To find out more about Yo-Yo Ma and his newest projects, visit our website at onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In a moment, I'll be joined by On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. First, let's listen back to the sounds of this past week.
Selecting Jerry Bremer, our country will be sending one of our best citizens. He's a man with enormous experience, a person who knows how to get things done.
The United States is prepared to keep any number of troops that are appropriate and necessary for in Iraq for as long as it takes to create a secure and permissive environment so that they can go about their business of reconstructing their country in a way and in a fashion politically and economically that makes sense.
There's no reason why a resolution lifting the sanctions on Iraq should take a prolonged period of time to discuss, and we think that this should be accomplished within the next couple of weeks.
This is the beginning, a partnership that will produce greater world stability, greater international involvement in world affairs, and a partnership with countries that will increasingly become valuable partners and allies of the United States.
More appeals court nominees have had to wait over a year for a hearing in my presidency than in the last 50 years combined. This is not just business as usual. This is an abdication of constitutional responsibility, and it is hurting our country.
We are achieving a sound and fiscally responsible agreement that will satisfy the dual critical challenges of both stimulating the economy while at the same time exercising fiscal restraint without unnecessarily driving up unsustainable federal budget deficits in the future.
And there's a week, President Bush names Paul Jerry Bremer his new special envoy to Iraq. Donald Rumsfeld suggests that it could take longer than a year to stabilize Iraq. U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations John Negroponte expects fast approval of a resolution introduced today to end U.N. sanctions against Iraq. Senator Tom Daschle hails the Senate's unanimous approval of the entry of seven new Eastern European nations into NATO. President Bush rails against Senate Democrats for holding up his judicial nominees and calls for reform of the judicial approval process. And the Senate Finance Committee votes to trim President Bush's tax cut to $350 billion. We heard Republican Senator Olympia Snowe of Maine expressing her approval. Chuck Beatty, some wheels turning in the Bush administration this week.
Yes, they are. And this is a week that began with the Democrats' first debate. And the administration is clearly, I think there are signs this week of turning to the center, which, of course, it has to do to win re-election. The most striking development was a UPI scoop that had it that in the middle of the war, Rumsfeld came to Condoleezza Rice and he said, we want to go into Syria, we want to do hot pursuit, perhaps even strike into Damascus. And she said, no more wars until after the election. And the North Korea settlement, or what was approaching there, seems to point in that direction. According to reporting earlier in the week, the president's willing to accept the fact that North Korea will start making a few bombs and to draw the line at the export of this stuff, at the proliferation of it. Of course, our friend Ash Carter thinks that's irresponsible, but very few Democrats are going to be criticizing him on that. And then the assault weapons ban, the president has decided to go along with its extension, a very brave thing, standing up to the NRA. And on his AIDS initiative, really, multi-billion-dollar AIDS initiative in Africa, he's standing up to the religious right because this is going to have to involve condom distribution, and it may even have to involve condom distribution through clinics that also give abortion. On the other hand, the day that last week that the U.S. ambassador to Israel presented the roadmap to Ariel Sharon, Elliot Abrams met secretly with Sharon, according to the Financial Times, and said, don't worry, we're not going to put any pressure on you to meet the roadmap.
So many kinds of moderation there. And not least, Jack, I guess at the end of the sound clips we just heard, Olympia Snowe referring to this agreement to hold tax cuts to $350 billion. Now, that's no pittance, but it's a lot less than the $700 billion plus the president was initially angling for.
Yes, and I think he will accept that. Although it remains to be seen what happens when the House, which wants $550 billion, and the Senate meet in conference. If he accepts it, that's a significant tack toward the middle, too.
So how do you read all this tacking toward the middle, Jack? Is this, again, positioning for presidential campaign?
That was the big puzzle about Bush. He just didn't make a single enemy on the right. And he didn't assume what is evident to anybody is they've got no place to go. They're going to vote for him no matter what, especially now that he's the conqueror of Iraq and he's still fighting for tax cuts.
So he can afford to go back toward the middle.
He can afford to go back, sure.
Well, and there's a lot of room open, given his starting point, a lot of room to move.
Sure.
Yeah. So there's political motion toward the center. Some good news there, some bad news maybe, and some very bad news from Iraq today, Jack. Another American journalist dead in Iraq, and again a journalist we knew well here at On Point. Elizabeth Neufer, correspondent for the Boston Globe, died in a car crash between Baghdad and Tikrit today. I was Elizabeth's editor at the Globe a decade ago or so when she went out on one of her first big foreign assignments covering the Gulf War, and she showed incredible grit in that war that we all came to understand in the years since as true courage. War and its aftermath, we are learning the hard way, mean death. But this death on the heels of Michael Kelly, who we also knew here, is again very close to home. Really feeling it tonight. It robs us of a courageous and clear-sighted journalist and friend who we will miss, the Boston Globe's correspondent Elizabeth Neufer, remarkable journalist and woman, dead today in Iraq at age 46, Jack.
Oh, my gosh. I think that was, of course, just Michael Kelly's age as well. Isn't it strange that we should be thus connected through the Atlantic Monthly and the Globe to two casualties of this war and connected, of course, to the 150 American families and friends who lost loved ones there as well?
Yeah, death makes terrible connections in wartime, and today we mourn the loss of Elizabeth Neufer, a real friend and a great journalist. Jack, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thank you, Tom.
On Point is produced by Meghna Chakrabarty, Eileen Imada, Tamar Morad, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, James Ross, Keith Shields, Karen Schiffman, and Tim Skog. With help from Chris O'Connor and Darren Manoogian, our senior producer is Graham Griffith. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This is WBUR.